All that we can say is we're infinitely grateful for the past and the contribution that people who have worked for decades and centuries have brought. Doug Engelbert hasn't quite been working for centuries, but it's close to. Most people will know of Doug Engelbert from using a mouse during their working life. A few of you may have seen the mother of all demos on YouTube back in 1968. I'm going to welcome to the podium Doug and a host of people who have worked with Doug or been inspired by Doug. And we're going to give you a picture. Now, where they're coming up, I invite you to stand up, stretch, wake up, and listen for it. Thank you. Do you want to sit first? Okay. Thank you. Do you get a sort of nourishment? Samba Morte. Thank you all. There's going to be a change in the conference as we go on, and it's in the spirit of John Mitchell's, Ambassador John McDonald's comment, and that is the role of women. You'll notice there's a stunning frequency of men and a stunning shortage of women. And our intention by the end of the week is that it never looks like that again. Now, we have a few rather powerful women around this place, so I think we can plot this. Okay, I'm going to introduce Rita?
Nikita
Sambamote, who's on the right-hand side, and then Valerie Landau. Nikita is a student who's studying some of the work that Doug Engelbert's been doing, and next I'm going to introduce Valerie Landau, who, amongst many other things, has been a biographer of Doug's work. And just to give you a sense of who he is before he speaks, Valerie's going to give a short introduction, then we're going to have Doug speak, and then some questions from Adam Apollo Walsh here, who is part of the future. Thank you.
Thank you and welcome. It's quite an honor to speak after an ambassador for peace and an astronaut, but here we go. So I first met Doug Engelbert 22 years ago when I was a young reporter, and I found out about his work, and it significantly changed my life. His vision for using technology to serve humanity and solve our complex problems facing the world was a huge motivating force, and that we need to augment our collective IQ. So Doug started when other people were using machines that looked like the ones you just briefly saw. He was talking about networking computers and using them to solve our problems, networked collaboration. And by 1968, he had developed almost all the technology that we're using here today. And many people don't know that. How many people here are familiar with Doug Engelbart? Okay. So in 1962, he wrote a visionary paper, which I suggest that you all reread, because there's so much, so many rich ideas in the paper. And while this was going on, he was basically inventing the future. And then I won't show the mother of all demos, since most of you have seen it, but... Okay. So I'm just going to show a short clip where Doug introduces the mouse as well as the corded key set. And one of the reasons I wanted to show this was because Nikita here and I are developing with Doug a glove that mimics a hand input device that mimics the corded key set that Doug is going to show. And so just to show that some of the ideas that Doug had been working on for so many years have been cast by the wayside, but when you really examine them, they're worth listening to. So here's a little piece of Doug introducing the handset and the corded key set in 1968 in San Francisco. We've got no audio.
Wait 1 second. Let's hear
it from coming out of the speaker back there. See? There you go. No, no, it's not.
Can you just start with the bird?
Sure. Okay, so you saw there a demonstration, and we're just going to give you a brief demonstration of how this works today here. So this is the...
Remember, this was done before we went
to... Yes, that was 1968. And so you can see that Nikita is just tapping with her hand right here in front, and she's able to type letters and combinations of letters. So this is something that we're working on particularly to help people with disabilities and repetitive stress syndrome because it will be free of the keyboard. But in addition to Doug's many most notable contribution, some of the things that he is responsible for and has won many, many prizes for is hypertext, word processing, multiple windows, the integration of multiple programs, including graphics, word processing, spreadsheets, email, online journals, all integrated into one package so that you're not opening all these separate applications from different companies and going crazy. So I work at a university and I see all these bright whiz kids using all kinds of technology, and not one of them can compete with Doug Engelbart on his Augment system. That when he sits down to do knowledge work, my jaw drops in awe. So I hope we listen very carefully and that we can take away, and that all of you hear the idea of coming together to work collectively, that Doug really does have the answers of how to do it. And so that I ask all of you to make the effort to dialogue with Doug to see how we can make a dynamic knowledge repository so that we can integrate all the knowledge we have. So with that, I'd like to welcome one of the most inspirational men I've ever met, Doug Engelbart.
I hate to disappoint you, but I'm only human. And it seems strange the prior two speakers were talking about such sweeping things out there in the world, or out of this world. And I kept thinking, you know, all I can show you is some of the kinds of thinking I've done, and try to give you a picture of what I think humanity could strive towards, etc.
So they've done all that working, but how do I advance it?
Oh, this technology is beyond me. Hey, it worked. All right. So it's like 55, 56 years ago. I'd been, you know, been off to college and in the middle of it, went off to World War II and came back and then was working. And I realized I didn't, suddenly one day, I didn't have any real professional goals. And so I overdid it. Yeah, I spent a few weeks thinking about it very hard. And I could really help go out and take on one of the big problems in the world. But every one of them I looked at just got more and more complex. And it took so much information about what was happening in the world. And so one day I said, instead of going after any one of the problems, maybe I could tackle this thing. As much as possible to boost mankind's collective capability for coping with complex, urgent problems. Because every one of those big, big problems has to be dealt with collectively. So this has been a pursuit now. It was 1951 when I did that. And so I quit my job and went off to graduate school. I just happened to pick Berkeley here. So it was kind of a kick coming back once in a while. But anyway, today I'm sort of, I've gotten used to this Millennium Project that Jerry Glenn has got going in there, and I just thought I'd just give you just sort of a brief push of this thing that they've done a lot of work about characterizing and giving a lot of detail on all these big problems. So if any of you is interested, it would be, I think, worthwhile going in. Yeah. So anyway, then I started working on this myself and saying, hey, how do we get better and better at understanding the problem, the possible solutions, the resources required, the resources available, etc. Almost every one of those steps is really complex in itself. Either understanding big complex things or handling and managing very complex projects, etc. And but these have to be dealt with collectively. And we heard an example here with the United Nations very, very carefully about that. And it's impressive. And so I got some heavy thinking for a while and came up with this picture. And I'll spend more time on it in more detail like that, of realizing that it's capability that was the central issue about how can you become capable of handling the complexity, and as an individual and as collectively as a society. And so I scribbled around and finally worked up this kind of capability infrastructure. That it isn't any one single thing you can just go plug. I wonder if somebody's playing a game. Can I play? Tell me the rules. Anyway, that any significant capability you or your group has is really embodied in an infrastructure of capabilities. And, you know, the one at the top may be your professional capability to carry on your job. Well, it's dependent upon a bunch of other things, you know, the kind of education you've had and so on, which is dependent upon something else. And down there and way down the list someplace is you have to, depending on your ability to speak at least one language and to write and the ability to use a telephone and just the ability to stand here and ignore those clicks. Anyway, I got really intrigued with that infrastructure. And then with the concept that lift up. With the realization that if you look at it by itself, and you says, oh, you want to talk to all the techie guys, and they'll say, ah, boy, this is what did it for you. You know, is all the different tools you can employ. And you say, well, that's interesting. Wonder which tools made the most difference. The most difference to what? Well, oh, there are a few other things that go on by this capability infrastructure, things that I had no better label for than to say the human system, but the social, cultural, organizational, etc. And then you says, oh, there are some more? Yeah, well, all those depend upon the basic human capabilities, and then they have to be conditioned. Good. Is this an IQ test? I just flunked. Oh. Maybe I'll learn. Anyway, so those basic human capabilities are really interesting, and we're all born with a subset of these things of certain quality. And you get skills and knowledge and training embedded within this human system, and you pick up very early different things of the artifacts or tool systems and going. And so they fit in there, but can you go in there and find out just exactly how would you structure the infrastructure of the capabilities that enable you to be adequately capable of carrying through your day's work, et cetera, and something like this. So it looked pretty strong, right? Complicated, so I decided I'd be more abstract about it and say, what kind of new capabilities could you get for what my there's one that says forward. Huh. So I was building this early in the time of computers, way back, and everybody was very much involved in this human-computer interface. And then the systems I was building, I was saying, look, capability is a basic thing that we're trying to achieve, and let's explore. But it turned out that most of the people involved in computer usage in the 1960s, 70s were just obsessed with this. It's got to be easy to learn and natural to use. And so they drew a line that pretty much pushed me out. But we got some good support for a while from the government, and we built a system that we called NLS, and it really involved capabilities. And among them was that little key set in there because you want to be really active in there. But other things, too, that were very important. It's like saying, how did we come to using books so much? And then realizing there's a paradigm that exists in our world that a book is the way to transmit and absorb symbolic knowledge. Oh, well, could a computer screen do any better? Well, there's the problems if you just look at it. But, oh, I don't mean just statically looking at it and scrolling like that. On a computer, you could very flexibly change views. And if you wanted, you could colorate different parts automatically. And, oh, just show me the first line of every paragraph. Or if it's big outline organizational, just show me the top level or the first two levels. Or only those paragraphs with certain content. So we just started emerging all that stuff together. And by late 60s, you know, a whole bunch of flexible ways in which you can move around and look at views. And it just was another extension to how you could couple to that basic sensory and perceptual machinery that's so marvelous here like this. And yet it just got washed out in the world. And I still use it every day, and it would be interesting to appeal to some larger community, of which this might be one, to say, how do we sort of unleash our humanity from these paradigms that say this is the way, you know, a book is the way, etc. Because I personally feel like books are going to be obsolete. And I made the mistake one time of mentioning that when I was giving a keynote address to the, who would you believe, the annual meeting of the Library Association of America. And it was just such an interesting experience just to feel the chill in the room. Whew. So I'm usually more selective in the audience, as I mentioned that, but it's funny how that kind of paradigms grow and exist, and they're just not questioned by people, that the book is the way, the page of a script and stuff like this. All right, so we did a lot, and we're still facing that paradigm. We just eventually got pushed out of the game because it could, and blackmailed or something. But this is a very interesting experience itself in living through something in a modern world where the paradigm was irresistible. It just pushed us right back. So anyway, it'd be a really interesting thing for the digital earth that can be the scale of thinking, as such like says, if we want to get out there in digital earth and we want to have the capabilities of our society to understand more and more and more and more clearly the nature of its problems and its opportunities to get done, let's just push it. Am I doing that? Let's just push it. Oh. Ah. It's loaded. Yeah. That's what I get for having a PhD in electrical engineering. Incidentally, when I got this big dream, I quit my job and used my GI Bill to come back to graduate school, and I picked Berkeley. And so this is where I got my PhD. And it was strange that I had this big dream of using computers interactively, that during World War II I'd been trained and served in the Navy as an electronic technician. One of the things you take care of is radar. And it puts things on a screen and, you know, marks them up. And so when I started thinking about this issue and problem in 1951, I'd read about computers. There were about five in the country, I guess. And I just knew if a computer could punch cards or print on paper, it could electronically put whatever you want on a screen and that you could interact with it like this. And yet, having that kind of background and the motivations of this sort just led me to start talking about that. And so I got my PhD and was enjoying teaching, and but I mistakenly started telling some of the, you know, more senior staff what my ideas were. And one of them just sat me down and said, hey, do you know how promotions handle universities? Well, I'm kind of a country boy, and I didn't get it. He just explained, you know, peer review. Your papers, you have to get papers published. It doesn't get published unless people reviewing them, who are peers out there, accept it, etc. And I can tell you right now, if you keep talking like that, you'll be an acting assistant professor forever. And nothing against the nice university here, but I believed and left, you know, whatnot. It was interesting. The steady sort of things. That was 1957, I believe. And the paradigm situation is still active. And yet, it's the kind of thing that this digital earth is really being bold about saying the kind of things we could do in the world. And so, one of the things is, it would be really interesting to get dialogue going about what can you do to augment people a lot more effectively. And one of the things is augment our collective ability to understand and govern, etc. And so there are quite a few details. And as I get going in details, is somebody going to stop me politely and say, oh, I see. Oh. Yeah. I think I'm beginning to master this. Ah, yes. So the claim is that this model as poles over scale. See? And so the thing I'm really interested in is the things at the far right. At that. So that scale of that augmentation system, so I boldly claim that one could apply that to whole countries and say, look, if you want to start picking capabilities and going after improving them, you need to do that. And and I had done some interesting studies for one of the, before I got on this kick, I was working with aeronautical scientists and testing models on air in wind tunnels. And so they explained to me this interesting scaling issue and problem. If you had small models in a wind tunnel, how you could translate the information. And so it's a real study about scaling. Like, here's a test. Like, if this room and everything in it, including all of us, suddenly got 10 times bigger, would you notice? And you can look and say, oh, well, he'd be 10 times taller, but he's 10 times farther away, and you wouldn't notice. Oh, well, how much more would you weigh? Oh, let's see. Volume, because 10 times 10, well, we'd weigh 1,000 times as much. Well, okay, how much stronger would you be? 1,000 times? No, that's proportional cross-section area, bones and muscles. So you'd only be 100 times stronger, but 1,000 times heavier. And that would be equivalent to you suddenly becoming 10 times heavier right now without anything else. And you and your chair couldn't hold you up. And such, oh, I see. So this led me to realize way back about the scaling down of components in computers. And that gave me the assurance that if people are pursuing that with components, they get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, they go faster and faster and pack more into that, so we'd have all the computing power we need. But it's a big interesting scaling thing in here, that if you're talking about something like Digital Earth or anything, in changing the practices of 100 people versus changing the skills and practices of millions, the scaling factor is serious, so you have to think of that. So something about the plan for how one can change Digital Earth or change digital population about our computer-aided or computer-augmented intellectual capabilities, the scaling comes in like that. So it affects that, and I gave that adequate thinking and serious. We won't know if it's adequate till we get the world to do it. So I guess all I'm hoping for is everybody here gets so enthusiastic to go and they start getting the world to move towards this collective IQ. See? But anyway, say it's a strategic capability and you say, here's a body of people. They're all interconnected and they've got the dialogue is recording and their collection about intelligence about what's going on in the world. Oh, thank you.
Came up with this term of
smaller and smaller and working faster and more efficiently and effectively together. So you can see the relationship between moving from large systems to small units, and that's really like moving from working as huge collectives organized into smaller organized groups that are coordinated more efficiently. So I'm going to make that relationship for you.
Well, am I coming across audio? Pardon? Oh, okay. I do both of them. Anyway, it was a collective process which was really bearing strongly all my feelings about this. So it still was that we were the very, very first people to bring the mouse in the screens and really flexibly saying, I want the screen to be really flexible about the way I move around, so we could jump very flexibly in that. But also in changing the views, which is something a book can't do. But the computer, we just had many, many views. So a very flexible system evolved from this. And it's just something that I'd like the world to start saying. Why is it that the way the computer systems of today are just like, you can fuss around and change a word here and there or something like this and copy it like this, but it's still like a book that I have to scroll through. And like I can jump flexibly, but why can't I jump to the third paragraph down or anything just very quickly, or just switch and show only the things that have the content I've asked for? There are many, many flexible views that can come out if you start thinking about it. The computer can provide those dynamically for you, but it takes a little skill and practice and interaction. And it says, oh, but that's too hard to learn. And so then you scratch your head about this business, about things that are too hard to learn. And you think that if you were grown up on an island with no society at all, and they bring you into society today, can you imagine how long it would take you to catch up? It's just very, 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 very basic things. So there's an immense amount that we've learned and we employ all the time in the way we work, think, operate, talk, etc. And so now you look at it and say, okay, if we're going to change that significantly, there's no way we can just unplug you into this environment, plug you into this other. And we have to something start facilitating the evolution. And it's a concurrent evolution with a lot of practices and skills and use of artifacts, etc. So this is the kind of thing then I started promoting to the people. But it finds a very stiff audience. It's called the modern world. This is the way we've done things. I don't want to change. But slowly you do change, but in stages that somehow are acceptably not overtaxing. And so that it really becomes an interesting challenge for society today, that saying, if there are improvements in capability that would really be very, very significant, that would require a fair amount of adaptation and change in basic things, can we afford to think about it? Well, the other thing is, if society has more and more opportunity every year of crashing altogether, can we afford not to take advantage of any of this thing? So anyway, this has been something that has seized me for 50 years now about that, about saying, hey, what's our collective IQ about appreciating the effort we may need to change or path we're going on, or the increasing complexity of the area ahead of us that we're moving towards, and the need to understand better, very basically. And anyway, so it's been, to me, a lonesome thing that there were many reasons that are understandable about the way society listens to crackpot, but I couldn't get across. The things I published just didn't seem to make any difference. And so I keep feeling like I'm just an Oregon country boy, that I didn't get it, that I just sit there and so stay quiet about that. But there's a chance to talk. Now, maybe afterwards people can talk and Timothy can sort of say, oh, digital earth, if we really want to use a digital technology, it would revolutionize. Books would, get supplanted by other means for us to study better and read better and communicate so much better and so on. And there's a whole field of understanding about using the machine we have here and using some of the perceptual machinery that you have in your being. And that perceptual stuff has fascinated me for a long time.
Do you know how it is that
you can be looking around and something catch your eye over here, and it might be some little wiggling thing that's gone. And yet, perceptually, it's a mouse. My house, but it's a mouse. Or something of this sort. But it's the machine in your head that takes some of the stimuli that comes through in your sensor organs and just has a way of grabbing like that, putting together a perceptual hook of understanding about what that is. And that's just fabulous. So you find that, hey, there's a lot of that you can put up on the screen. And I've got an experiment I think maybe this summer I can get somebody to try it for me, but it's like, I know that there are computer programs that can go through a text and analyze it syntactically, what the syntactic parts of speech are. And I can never remember them myself in high school or so on. But it says, if you can do that, and you make unique coloration of the different parts of speech on that screen, then I'm betting that as people start, even if they, like engineer Doug, can't remember the different parts of speech, but you start reading that, and I bet that perception machinery starts adapting until pretty soon it's really relying on that. You're reading faster and more comprehensively because of that coloration. Gives that machinery a chance to grab the parts of speech and put them into place. And so I'm going to try that sometime. And maybe I would say, well, let's see. We'll take odds here about whether or not it will make a difference. Anyway, this model, and I've come to call it a dynamic knowledge repository, that the kind of gathering of the knowledge and putting it together and saying that this would be the way to focus on collective IQ. And how can you better and better get to be a dynamic repository that really, really carries the best possible understanding of a complex agent system? For instance, global warming. See? So why isn't there a place you can go that's essentially a hypermedia interlinked, organized knowledge base that will tell you the things you don't have to have a specialist come and give you the lectures or something. And then any of the arguments about what could you do about it, okay, then that would link off to situations that are extremely complex thing about trying to change it. And all we have to do is drop our carbon emission. Oh, I see. That's all? And it's been fascinating me to watch the freeways every time I'm commuting to work to see how a long train of cars spewing out carbon dioxide and some carbon monoxide too, I guess. But anyway, the complexity of it. You said, well, we're going to boost the price of gasoline at the pump. Okay, that'll slow it down. But then all the effects on the economy and family life, on who? Oh, boy. So there's so much concurrent change needs to be done. So anyway, so going after these dynamic knowledge repositories, just says, it'd be very, very handy to have them. So he says, here's a group of people pursuing something that they've made their dynamic knowledge repository. But then, as it scales up, you realize it's part of a much bigger collection of individuals and people, of which they're all individually doing it, but collectively they need something like that too. say some young university or something would need its picture like that. But the whole country, the whole digital earth needs to have its EKI. I think it's going to be effective. So how do you have those evolving concurrently? So the challenge for whatever technology is used to manage the knowledge in there is high. But it's something that's a direct challenge that can be pursued. And anyway, I talk about you can't specify the design for our future capability infrastructure. It's too complex. So you have to depend upon the evolutionary process. And so you can learn to facilitate it. So that's the kind of message I come up to doing like that, just saying, great. And so the digital earth pursuit like this is saying, there's much evolving in the societies and all of the artifacts and the organizations and everything in the world today. And it's got to evolve towards something that we know could survive and exist more or less permanently. So the best we can do is facilitate that evolution. And now that I've given you this complete answer, that's way off and continues to say, okay, now I told you how to do it, go ahead. So how do you evolve it and so like this? And so the this thing of looking in this space of how far along has your society developed its tool system and its human system? And someplace in there, and so the most advanced in both is the red one, of course. We'd say this community right here, of course. And you say, well, how's it going? You can anticipate the tool system out there like it is and more human system change. But really, it's just a lot more there that's shaping up in the future about all of this. And the frontier, that more like that. See, where all that's out there that you can almost foresee, but instinctively you can tell it's that much more sophisticated artifacts and tools coming up, and the corresponding changes in our human social system is that big. So that's a big frontier. And so he says, okay, if you come from the United States with the history we have of going out there, he says, okay, the best routes, the outposts like that. You say, well, you set up outposts. Yeah. So this is one of the challenges for all that's out there, because for every society that's there, it's going to be massaged into its evolution, or it's going to start having some guidance in itself about where it's going to go out there. And it would be nice to have that frontier sort of mapped out. So that's, I could tell you exactly how it, you know. So this is the kind of thinking I've been doing for so many years. And I wish I knew better how to lay it out in some straightforward like this and draw a boundary before, you know, beyond which I don't keep talking. And I think my instinct is, I'll quit here. And there's a lot of thinking about this thing I mentioned earlier about dynamic knowledge repository. Is how does a group of people worry about a given issue and topic aggregate the knowledge in there in such a way that it's maximally understandable for new people entering it, that it handles in an appropriately effective way all of the disagreements and arguments and anything else like this. And there are structured ways of handling this thing that advanced hypermedia, that's the kind of hypermedia pursuits I was working on, can really help keep that structure so that your dynamic knowledge repository can be really much more, it's very clear when there's something there that's unproven or challenged, because there are links, etc., that help show you, oh, that is, you can go off and look at where the challenges are and what the questions are. But this is the kind of thing that then could be worked on and grown, and all kinds of different people could participate in tossing in things and giving the linkage how they think that they could go. And it has to be somewhat more structured and all than a wiki, but 20 minutes. But anyway, someplace we need to get for the collective IQ of a big society hunk is their dynamic knowledge repository that gives their picture of the problems and issues that they're facing. And someday it is, and people keep hinting to me because I'm only 82 years old, but I still keep trying. They're hinting to me that I better start planning on not going on forever. And so just to be nice to them, I'm saying, I think what I have to do is hand over to you guys. But this is an issue and a challenge, and I guess you could run away from it or something. But I'd just be very delighted about working with you to have a new version, new move ahead about how are we going to do this correlation frontier. It's having especially to do with how we build our collective IQ. So thank you.
I would say Doug has quite handed it over to us already. Every day we sit down at our computer and our hand goes on to a device that is meant to connect us to more than just ourselves, right? This is about human interface. And what we've seen as we've created these global visualization systems is we've actually gained the human experience of leaving the atmosphere and looking at the entire planet rotating in front of us. If you look at his video, you see that he's talking about learning how to use this human interface in a way that can externalize the knowledge resources within us. And that is the key to how we can collaborate with each other. Because if we know, if we understand how to use our human interfaces, and we create repositories and systems, as Doug has designed, to capture information in a way that is in alignment with how our own bodies and minds capture and share information, then we're talking about more than just biomimicry. We're talking about externalizing evolution and realizing our internal and external interface in that evolution, that that doesn't just happen inside of us, that our process of growth happens both inside of us as well as outside of us, and requires each and every one of us with each other to do that work. So I just want to give my deep gratitude and appreciation to Doug for all of your work, for all of this time. You have made such an incredible impact on so many people, including this gentleman sitting here who wasn't introduced, by the way. His name is Bernd Wall. And Bernd has so many stories to tell about the way that Doug's work has literally transformed every sector of technology you can think of. So I know we're almost out of time, but I really want to invite you to talk to Bernd about some of those stories. And
maybe I should read off of one story.
Thank you.
So 10 years, I'm standing here. Doug, I'm standing by me because Doug has been a good friend for many years. And at the 50th anniversary of ACM, which is the Association for Computing Machinery, which is really the largest and oldest organization of computers, they had in San Jose created an archaeological dig of kind of the history of computing. But there were a lot of really innovative projects, and there was this group of college students that had come up and gotten these large Onyx machines to show a visualization of Earth. And their trackball was a giant globe. And you could roll this trackball, and then you could go any part in the world, and then you could press another button and zoom in. And many years later, I met with John Hinckley, who was the CEO of Google Earth, and Doug and I saw this, and we were probably thinking, you know, this is going to be on people's desktops in maybe 5 or 10 years. And so So John Hinckley was CEO of Keyhole and was head of Google Earth. I said, were you there at the 1997 ACM conference, and were these machines the inspiration for Google Earth? And he goes, how did you know? And if you see technologies that are evolving in universities or young students are thinking about things, you know, in 5 and 10 years, that may be on the desktop of most people in the world. And that's how I think we're going to do the collaboration. So, Doug, you've been a real inspiration to us and a lot of other people. And hopefully we'll be able to pass that on to the new generation of thinkers and collaborators in the world.